This podcast of Word of Mouth is sponsored by
Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money
through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto,
home, and personal loans.
Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org.
Federally insured by NCUA.
Equal housing opportunity.
And Dartmouth Hitchcock.
Creating a new model for healthcare.
Where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us.
A sustainable system
improving the health of our communities
for years to come.
Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And Doucet Survey.
Serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England.
Now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine.
Information at DOUCETSurvey.com. That's DoucetSurvey.com.
Word of Mouth.
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 Word of
Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. More than 750 million people around the world do not have access to safe drinking water, and at least 2 billion lack access to proper sanitation. A project funded by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation proposes a solution for both. The OmniProcessor, a low-cost waste treatment plant, can turn up to 14 tons of sewage into drinkable water each day. Although a completely sanitary technology, waste-to-water treatment faces an overwhelming oppositional force: disgust. The foundation acknowledged as much by releasing a video of Bill Gates himself drinking a glass of OmniProcessed water. When it comes to environmental and social concerns, disgust may play a much larger role in shaping policy than we think. Maria Konnikova writes about psychology and science for The New Yorker, both of which came together in a recent article called Problems Too Disgusting to Solve. And Maria, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So the technology for turning human waste into drinking water, that's been around for some time. Is revulsion the only thing holding it back from being adopted?
To be perfectly honest, I think that it's, if not the only thing, then certainly the single most important thing. Because as you say, we've had this technology for years and years, and we've had people trying to sell it internationally. We're not just talking about the United States. There are lots of areas where there are water shortages. Singapore, California could definitely use something like this. But people just refuse to drink it because they hear recycled water. They think toilet to tap. They think, oh my God, this cannot possibly be safe. I don't care what you tell me. My instinct is to say, this is disgusting.
Well, and the disgust is so automatic, it's so instinctive and irrational. Is there an evolutionary reason we developed it?
Absolutely. And the reason is actually very solid. A lot of the things that evoke disgust in us should evoke disgust in the sense that they can hurt us. So, you know, sometimes you'll be in an area, you'll be walking, and suddenly it's very slimy, and you say, ooh, this feels gross, I want to get out of here. Well, chances are there are actually lots of bacteria that are living there, so that's a very natural thing to say. You should get out. When we think about a disgust to sewage and to raw human waste, that's pretty much universal. There's no culture that doesn't have that.
Mm-hmm.
And that has a very good reason, too. Sewage and raw waste has so many pathogens, and one of the ways that people die most frequently, and this is still a problem in many parts of the developing world, is because sewage gets into drinking water, it gets into what you eat, and you get incredibly sick. So disgust is a very instinctive reaction, and it's a very good reaction. The problem is when that same circuitry gets short-circuited because we're living in a very different world than the world of our ancestors.
Yeah, what are some of the things that won't harm us, but still people are commonly, let's say, disgusted by?
Well, recycled water, obviously, but also things like eating insects, for instance. We are facing global food shortages. We are facing global warming, where we know that the production of meat in the way that it's currently produced contributes to the gases that are released into the environment. And we have insects, which are a perfectly legitimate form of food. And in fact, in many cultures, you know, many parts of South America, for instance, people traditionally consume insects all the time, you know, ants, grasshoppers, cockroaches even. And when you ask a local Joe from your neighborhood coffee shop, are you going to eat an insect? He'll say, absolutely not. That's really gross. Unless you get someone who's very exceptional. Some people say that they're happy to do it, but that's really the exception to the rule. Then you say, well, what about if I grind up the insect so that it's part of flour and just a very tiny proportion of flour? And this is actually a study that was done by Paul Rosen at the University of Pennsylvania who studies disgust. Still, they say, no, thank you. I think I'd rather pass. So there's another area. Things like GMOs, we think that that's disgusting because it's not natural, because something's been done to it. So we see it in public policy all the time, but it's not just there. You see it in kind of moral issues, like things that have been touched by people that you personally find repugnant. You don't want to touch them. Yeah. Like if I ask you, do you want to wear Hitler's sweater? What are you going to tell me?
Well, no way. No way in the world would I wear a Hitler sweater.
What if I say, well, what if I unravel it and I'm going to make a totally different sweater for you and I'm going to make sure that that yarn is really well disinfected?
I can't believe like what this is doing to the back of my shoulders right now. There really is this sense of like, I would not want that to touch my skin.
Exactly. And that is the exact reaction that people get when they see all of these things. It's a concept that's known as contagion. And the psychology behind that is very simple. And that's once in contact, always in contact. So Hitler's sweater was once associated with Hitler. He wore it. It was a part of Hitler. And no matter what you do, once in contact, always in contact.
Well, one of the interesting things about that is the opposite reaction, that there can be a kind of notion of purity that can, for lack of a better word, contaminate the bad thing. Like one of the other things that Rosen tested is if people wouldn't wear Hitler's sweater, what if Mother Teresa wore the same sweater?
Mm-hmm. That's exactly right. Because this is happening on such a abstract moral level, you know, it's this moral revulsion, the only thing that really can counteract it is an incredibly strong force in the opposing direction. And it has to be as strong as Mother Teresa. It can't just be, you know, the local priest, for instance. It has to be someone who you really think is the epitome of good, just like Hitler was the epitome of bad.
So when do we first begin to discuss this? Because I notice, like, you know, kids certainly say, oh, ick, that's gross. You know, they don't want to touch something or eat something.
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. And it turns out that we do develop this pretty early on, around 3 years of age. And first, you have babies and very small children who have absolutely no notion of disgust. So one of the things, and, you know, I started laughing out loud when Paul Rosen and I were talking, and he mentioned this because it had never even occurred to me. He said, you know, children don't just wear diapers to keep themselves clean. It's also to prevent them from eating what's in the diaper.
Oh, my goodness.
Because apparently if they're just allowed to, they will, because it's interesting. At that age, there's really no notion of disgust. But then when they're 3, maybe 4 years old, something seems to shift, and suddenly they'll say, ew, that's gross. I don't want to touch that. And some of those things are very universal. So, for instance, around that age, basically no children will eat what's in their diaper again. But some of the things are very culturally determined. So a kid growing up, say, in New Hampshire might say an insect is gross to eat, but mm-hmm. someone growing up in Mexico might not.
Well, I'm also wondering about, like, if we as humans outgrow that disinhibition to eating, you know, weird things, like a kid could conceivably eat an insect.
Mm-hmm.
As the developing world grows and, you know, more people want meat, more people want cars, that kind of thing, does their image of disgust change as they get further and further away from that baseline survival?
Well, unfortunately, it seems to become stronger. So the older we are, the more hardwired our instinctual reactions seem to be. The kids can still be pretty flexible. You could probably convince a 5-year-old that it's okay to eat an insect much more quickly than you could convince a 50-year-old. But there's one thing that goes in the opposite direction, which is necessity.
Mm-hmm.
So if you put me in an area that's suffering from severe drought and there's literally no water, you know, I cannot get it from any source, and then I bring in recycled water and I'll say, here's recycled water, you can drink it, or you can die, then I'm going to overcome my disgust reaction pretty darn quickly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, in the same way I have a colleague who, you know, the thought of raisins just provokes her gag reflex. But if she were really hungry, I'm guessing she would eat raisins.
Exactly. And, you know, if we were freezing somewhere, we would put on Hitler's sweater pretty quickly.
Right. Well, so the problem is psychological, basically.
Mm-hmm.
But can we break that cycle of disgust, especially when you're talking about the future of toilet tap water,
mm-hmm.
which probably shouldn't use the term toilet tap water if you're trying to market it.
That's exactly right. I haven't actually seen any good way of putting it, because as soon as you say toilet to tap, as soon as the notion of toilet is anywhere in there, I think red lights go off no matter what I tell you afterwards. But yes, there are certain things, short of making Mother Teresa drink the water, that do seem to help. One of those is the notion of distance. So we can get over these feelings of immediate disgust if we think that we're further removed from the source. So say, you know, you have water that's treated at this plant, and then it travels thousands of miles for many months, and only then do you drink it. Somehow that makes it more palatable than what Bill Gates is showing, which is, hey, look, 5 minutes ago, this was sewage, and now I am drinking this. Isn't it wonderful? Well, sure, it's pretty incredible technologically, but psychologically, that closeness only makes the disgust reaction stronger. So we can try to couch all of this in ideas of distance, of time, of, you know, oh, this is actually very, very far removed from the thing that you found disgusting. And the other thing is, you know, marketing, plain and simple. Who do you associate with this water, and how do you see it? So if, you know, you have someone very famous who says, you know, hey, my name is Angelina Jolie, and here's me drinking recycled water because it's wonderful and it's safe, and I'm now going to be giving my entire family this water. Well, people do tend to emulate celebrities and people they look up to, so those types of things might actually help.
Maria Konnikova, author, journalist, and she writes a weekly science and psychology column for The New Yorker. Maria, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Now, you can read Maria's piece for yourself, Problems Too Disgusting to Solve. That's at wordofmouthradio.org. We also have a link to the video of Bill Gates drinking the omni-processed water. All right, here's something just about everyone will agree is disgusting, the maggot. And yet, no matter how repulsive, maggots play an important role in the ecosystem. Here's producer Paula Kahumbu on why we should think of maggots as our friends.
No, that's not the sound of a juicy piece of steak sizzling on the barbecue. That's the sound of millions and millions of maggots chewing their way through a juicy piece of steak out here in the Nairobi National Park. Hi, I'm Paula Kahumbu. And I'm here in the Nairobi National Park with Dino Martins, and we're looking at a cow that's died just in the river right on the edge of the national park. He's trying to convince me that I really should care much more for the tiny little critters, even if they really stink.
Well, it's not the maggots that stink, but it's actually the putrefying tissues of the cow. And the more the maggots feed, actually, there'll be less and less stink, because what the maggots will do is take the flesh, feed on it, and turn it into fat maggots that turn into flies that turn into food for flycatchers and drongos. And basically it means this cow will turn into flycatchers, into drongos, into dragonflies, into all these other things in the ecosystem that we love, into fish, into crabs, into even plants.
Ugh, so we're going to end up eating this cow whether we like it or not, even though it's
dead. Yes, the cow is dead, but it's becoming part of the earth again.
They're not ambling, they're kind of inching along in peculiar lines, actually.
Yes.
Why are they doing that?
So what they're doing is maggots tend to facilitate each other's feeding. And what you can see here is there's some concentrations of them, and they are several different species. So they all look like they're just one sort of big squishy mass. But if you look closely, you'll notice there's some which have sort of spikier bodies. And those are the larvae primarily of the very large blowflies that are the bright iridescent green and purple that we see flying around and landing on the carcass. And then there's some smaller ones that are longer and smoother. Those are the larvae of these other flies, which we would call house flies or domestic flies.
So how long does it take? I can see some tiny little ones in there. How long does it take from the time that the fly lays his egg to the maggot eating this cow and then turning back into a fly?
Now, because carcasses generally tend not to be around for very long, flies are very efficient at converting it, and it generally takes 5 to 7 days for a maggot to complete its life cycle from the time the egg is laid. It'll form a pupa, and actually you can see some pupal masses down here, and often they'll go off around the edges of the carcass or into the soil or in the hair. If we were to open some of these dead bits of the hair, we would probably find pupae.
Okay, you said you think they're beautiful. Just tell me the truth, Dino. You don't really think that maggots are beautiful?
I really think maggots are beautiful.
Oh, my God, you're disgusting.
Because of what they're doing. Just think how the horror we're surrounded by here, all these dead cows, and just think, if it wasn't for these maggots cleaning it up, would you like to clean it up, Paula?
I wouldn't. Actually, you know what? I'd like to just get out of here right now. It stinks so bad, I'm going to throw up in a minute.
Thank you, maggots.
And that piece was produced by Paula Kahumbu for Wildlife Direct. And I promise, it is the last stomach-churning thing that you're going to hear on today's show. Up next, we know plenty of people think that Bruce Springsteen is God. When we come back, our series The Uncommon Core continues with a look at a class that analyzes religious themes in his music. That's when Word of Mouth continues after a short break. Each Thursday, we bring you our series, The Uncommon Core, an exploration of unusual courses being taught in colleges and universities across the country. Like many of the classes we've covered so far, this episode takes something that may be familiar and urges students to look at it from a critical perspective.
Hi, my name is Azan Yadin Israel. I'm an associate professor at Rutgers University, where I teach in the Jewish Studies and Classics departments. And I'm going to be talking about a course that I developed last year called Springsteen's Theologies. Born down in a dead man's town, the first kick it took was when I hit the ground. I think Springsteen's interesting because he actually uses a lot of biblical and theological imagery in a very explicit way when he opens a song, the song Adam Raised a Cain, with the lines, "In the summer that I was baptized, my father held me by his side." That's just not something that you come across very often in rock and roll. There are a number of artists like Bob Dylan.
I got nothing to say about these things I write. I mean, I just write them.
Or Leonard Cohen.
Suzanne takes you down.
Who are kind of more like, they have this image of the poet, writer. The troubadour to some extent. Springsteen's a big stadium rock and roll singer, and to find those kinds of lyrics in his work is surprising and intriguing.
Well, Jesus was an only son as he walked to Calvary.
Sometimes students or people that hear me lecture, they'll say, but you know, I heard that Springsteen doesn't go to church, or I heard that he didn't and now he does, or none of that is really relevant. I don't know the man. I'm not trying to say anything about his religious beliefs. It's really about his work as an artist rather than him as an individual.
Nuns run bald through Vatican halls, pregnant, pleading immaculate conception.
Well, there are different songs for different periods of his writing. Early on, songs from his first album, such as Lost in the Flood. And later in Born to Run, the main song that I discuss is Thunder Road. And basically all of Darkness on the Edge of Town. I mean, that album is really, really full of theological motifs. Promised Land, even Racing in the Street. I'd say that one of the most interesting things that's emerged from this class is that there's a very clear arc in Springsteen's writings that deal with theological and biblical issues, we can see in the class as we read the songs, we can see that as a very young man, he was writing some angry and starkly anti-religious and particularly anti-Catholic songs. In Born to Run, he develops a new paradigm where there's redemption, but it's redemption that's in this world. It's a here and now redemption. And then maybe the most astounding moment is that right after the success of Born to Run, he releases Darkness on the Edge of Town, which systematically dismantles the positions that he adopted earlier on. So, I mean, it's interesting to see the development of an artist in this way.
Seen a man stand over a dead dog by the highway in the ditch.
Since teaching this class, I've really gained appreciation for his work and for the extent to which his lyrics repay very, very close reading, very patient reading. I have gone from being just a fan who enjoyed Springsteen's music to, I think, having a deeper appreciation for what he's done as a writer.
Still at the end of every hard day, people find some reason to believe.
Uncommon Core is produced by Taylor Quimby. You can find more on Bruce Springsteen's theologies at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. Whether you follow the religion of Bruce or even religious at all, you're probably still familiar with the commandment, thou shalt not steal. Well, we're going to return with a hard-hitting investigation into how that commandment is being broken in offices across the country. Thou shalt not steal from the office fridge when Word of Mouth returns.
Word of mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. If you've ever worked a 9-to-5 job, spent any time in a cubicle, or even had roommates, you're probably familiar with a common yet deeply personal violation. And the podcast, The Sporkful, is airing a 3-part investigation into the epidemic. Office fridge theft.
So my dinner shift comes up. I'm looking forward to this pizza, of all things. I open it, and one slice is missing. Just one.
Heather wrote it off. Lots of people in the office ordered from Schlotzky's. Maybe it was an honest mistake. Turned out, it was just the beginning.
The 6-inch sub. That's the one that nailed it.
And that is where the investigation begins. In 2001, when Heather Coleman became a victim. Dan Pashman is host of WNYC's podcast, The Sporkful, and is here to talk about Heather's case and the broader politics and morality of office food theft. Dan Pashman, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks, Virginia.
All right, so what happened to Heather's 6-inch sub?
Well, it's quite a tale. So a third of the sandwich disappeared, and this happened repeatedly. And not only did her food keep disappearing, but it was always, as she says, always only a part of the food, not the whole thing, which was especially perplexing for her.
So how often did this happen?
Well, it happened a lot when she first started this job. And once every few weeks on a regular basis, it was really tormenting her, keeping her awake at night. Finally, she just stopped using the communal fridge because she couldn't figure out who was doing it. And she went to extreme lengths. I mean, way beyond just leaving nasty notes like many people have done. She took a sandwich and put it in a plastic container and wrapped the whole container in duct tape. And the thief sliced through the duct tape.
No.
Eventually, the thief got careless, is what happened.
Okay. Well, let's just talk episode by episode here, because we're in the first episode. We discover that, like you said, the culprit would just take little pieces. So what do you think the motive is in that case? Why not just eat the whole thing?
Well, that's something that we explore in this episode of the Sporkful podcast. And I actually talked to a guy named Baron Ambrosia, who hosts a show on Cooking Channel and is himself in his show occasionally a food thief. And I try to get into the mind of of this person, the motive. And what he says, and I'm inclined to agree, he says, this is not a crime of hunger because the person didn't finish the food. It's not a crime of culinary curiosity. You know, it's not like this is such an exotic delicacy, I must have some, because it's like a turkey club sandwich.
Mm-hmm.
So that's not the reason. He thinks that the reason is basically an underlying need for intimacy.
Oh.
That it's about intimacy. That what this food thief is doing is sort of two steps away from sniffing someone's chair.
The pathology gets thicker and thicker. I mean, this almost like, I don't know, I would almost think somebody had a food disorder if they did, just as happened to Heather, just took the chicken out of a burrito. I mean, something else is going on here.
Yeah, no, there's certainly, this is not your run-of-the-mill food theft story. This thing, and I want to stress, it is really a true story. Heather's story is a true story. People have listened to the podcast and they're like, why'd you pick Elkhart, Indiana? And I'm like, because that's where it happened. So it is a true story, and it is very strange. So she has this burrito that gets just mangled. Normally this food thief is very meticulous, but mm-hmm. then the thief gets careless and leaves this burrito, like, I mean, just like the burrito's torn open, but everything is left there except the chicken. The food thief picked out the chicken and left the rest there for all to see.
Mm. Well, let's hear a clip of Heather's reaction to some of the incidents. This one I find quite interesting.
Food is so personal. Like, for example, if someone used up like all my Kleenex or all my Post-its, I would just go get another one and it would be no big deal. But the touching of my food, I really felt violated.
There is an emotional response there, and I'm thinking that the response to food does really outweigh the severity of a crime. I mean, if you really think about it, it's a six of a Subway sandwich or a slice of pizza. I mean, why is it so emotional?
That's right. I mean, it's not in reality, it's not like it's irreplaceable. But there is something very personal and intimate about food. And there's something I've heard from a lot of Sporkful listeners in working on this series, is that there's also something that happens when you are looking forward to food that you have in the fridge. Like if it's leftovers or something special you brought in from home.
Mm-hmm.
I talked to a woman in Florida who's very upset because she had this gourmet salsa that someone went to town on. You know, and so when you're looking forward to it and then you find that it's not there, it's that much more painful.
Mm. Well, one of my colleagues, she brought in some almond butter, fresh, you know, new jar of almond butter, and discovered it had been opened, the seal had been taken off of it, and a big knife full of almond butter had been taken out of it. And she started thinking, you know, what kind of monsters do I work with? You start looking at everybody who works with you as suspect.
That's right. That's right. And that's something I'm going to get into more in part two. We hear more stories of office fridge food thievery. And we even have it here at WNYC also.
Mm.
There's a famous story in these halls about the kombucha fairy who replaced some stolen kombucha. That was a big scandal.
Uh-huh.
But it is, and I've never heard anything like that. That's extreme. For someone to open a sealed container is extreme. But one of the things we get to in next week's episode of The Sporkful is a debate over whether it's ever okay. You know, because I was surprised how many Sporkful listeners wrote in and said, actually, I think in this situation, that situation, taking someone else's food is okay.
Okay, so what is okay? I mean, I kind of think, where do you stand on condiments, for example, like salad dressing and butter?
I think you should try hard not to take other people's. Like, you should never bring in a dry salad banking on the fact that you know that this other guy always has his vinaigrette. But if you're in a pinch and you need a condiment and you didn't bring it yourself, I think, look, if it's a small amount, it's not the worst thing you could do. And I've done that a few times, and I'm sure it's been done to me. If you're the kind of person who absolutely cannot handle anyone touching or even taking a drop of your ketchup or salad dressing, then don't put food in the office fridge.
Mm-hmm.
You do have to assume a basic amount of risk.
So condiments, meh. But when do you cross the Rubicon or into really egregious office food theft?
I think any time that you are taking someone's actual like entree food, a piece of a sandwich or pizza or anything like that, like you're actually taking a portion of their meal you've crossed a line. I think if you're talking about a condiment, a rogue peanut, it's not the worst thing in the world. But when you're eating someone else's sandwich, you've crossed the line.
Well, why do you think it happens at the office in particular? What is there about this environment that leads to this just rampant theft?
Well, I don't know that it's something inherent with the office, because I think that this kind of thing happens in communal fridges in apartments. You know, if you have a group of young people living in sharing an apartment, three, four, five of them share a fridge, there's often tension among roommates. I think it's more just with communal fridges. You know, people have a funny way of justifying their own behavior a lot of times and rationalizing it. And I think that's what happens a lot of times. Sometimes there can be revenge food theft. Sometimes people are just selfish. But I have a guy in next week's show who says that he thinks it's a public service sometimes, because the way he argues it, he says, look, there's only so much space in the fridge. If people have clogged the fridge up with a bunch of stuff that they're not finishing, A, I'm helping the community by clearing space in the fridge, and B, I'm eating something that would otherwise have gone bad and been thrown out.
We're laughing about this. It is a really funny situation on some level, but people do get really mad about it. But it is theft, after all. So is there an indication, do you think, that if somebody's going to open up your almond butter and steal a knifeful or take the chicken out of your burrito, is there something else at play here? Another kind of theft?
I mean, I think if you're going to go with the strict definition of theft, taking something that isn't yours without permission, even a dropper full of ranch dressing, I mean, I think if you're talking about something pathological like Heather's story, or I mean, I think opening up someone's container of almond butter is extreme. I'd like to think that there's space in society for us to all sort of share condiments and salsa to a basic extent without seeing accusations of theft thrown around. I mean, can we all just eat along?
Dan Pashman, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thanks, Virginia.
Dan Pashman is host of the WNYC podcast, The Sporkful, and there is a 3-episode serial-style treatment of office fridge theft currently online. You could look at wordofmouthradio.org to hear it. He's also author of the book Eat More Better, How to Make Every Bite More Delicious. And we would love to hear your thoughts on office fridge theft. Have you ever taken a squirt of someone else's salad dressing? Is a tub of butter fair game? Or have you been the victim of office fridge theft? Join the ongoing conversation at facebook.com/wordofmouthradio. Okay, so sneaking a little salad dressing from the office fridge is relatively harmless. But rustling a full pen of cattle is a different story. When Jeff Emerson started buying cattle in the early 90s, he was paying as much as $5,000 a head, while other farmers were only spending a few hundred. That's because Emerson was buying a rare breed of Italian cattle called Piedmontese, because, according to him, the meat tastes better. So he was even harder hit when some of his neighbors allegedly stole $100,000 worth of cattle off of his ranch, hurting his business for years to come. This story comes to us from Oklahoma's media company, This Land Press.
Finally dawns on you that these cattle are nowhere in the woods. These cattle are nowhere to be found. We've hunted the roads and stuff like that for talked to neighbors, so we're blue in the face. And then when you finally find the gate where they've been going in and out of, you feel kind of violated. Wrestling is big time right now. Cattle prices, commodities are just expensive, corn, oil, everything, but cattle prices are way up. And so what used to be an old $300 cow is now a $1,000 cow. There's lots of cattle stolen. I mean, 10,000 head last year in Texas. I think we was on track for 3,500 or something like that in Oklahoma in 2010. It's actually pretty easy, believe it or not. With my cattle, all I have to do is go, oh, and here they come running. Because you don't want wild cattle. You want your cattle to be around you. You want them used to you calling them and stuff like that. And so when they hear somebody call, here they come. And then they funnel them down into a pen, back up their stock trailer, and they just run them into the stock trailer. You know, in a matter of a few hours, they're in Texas with them. Or they're in anywhere. And there's a sale going on every single day of the week almost somewhere within 200 miles of Tulsa. I mean, there's even sales on Sundays in some places. So they can load those things up, and at a sale barn, you can just pull up there and you can just say, I'm Joe Blow, wait for the cattle to sell and get your check and go.
My name's Jeff Emerson
with Natural Farms in Tulsa. We had some cattle stolen off the farm, wrestled off the farm about a year and a half, 2 years ago. I counted on the day after April Fool's Day. And then we counted again, brought them in and counted them again on the 4th of July weekend. And we were a minimum of 36 down. And we hunted the farm and, you know, went around, drove around neighbors and stuff. But you can see where there used to be an old gate between us and a neighbor, and had a little old chain and lock through it. And and it had been sitting there for 10 years and never been opened. And all of a sudden, you could see where it had been opened. They cut the chain, cut the lock. There was traffic backing through, hoof traffic backing through there. We ear tag them, but an ear tag you can cut out easily. Boom, you can have it gone. A lot of the cows that were stolen would have been having calves. Those calves, some of them were going to be the ones we're going to be butchering. That's really impacted us now because we're not necessarily in the cattle business. We're in the meat business. We do all our own processing, make our own sausages and everything like that, smoke our own meats. People are coming to us to actually get a steak. So instead of having a full pen full of cattle or, you know, on feed, now we're down some. And so sometimes people come in and say, okay, I need an arm roast. And I'm like, I don't have an arm roast. I'm out. You know, and it's going to be a few more months before we're able to make that up. We know who actually did this. It's just the proof and trying to prove it. So it's... The last thing the Department of Ag told us was go get a private investigator. Well, they stole $100,000 worth of cattle, but it's going to probably cost me $50,000. And so at some point in time, you have to say, okay, I can't spend any more. It's so bad. Here you are, you're having to pack a gun around with you, and you'd hate to just kill a man over an old cow. But it is your asset, and it's just like him breaking in your house and stealing a necklace out of your drawer. It just makes you madder than hell.
And our thanks to This Land Press for that story. Well, after a brief spring thaw earlier this week, we are back in the grips of sub-freezing temperatures. Up next, we're going to demystify one of winter's impressive, sometimes dangerous creations, icicles, when word of mouth returns. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. It has been a brutal winter here in the Northeast, and all of that packed snow on rooftops has made for some impressive, in some cases, scary icicles on display. But let's consider the icicle for a moment. Where do they come from, and what accounts for their distinctive shape? There is a surprising amount that we do not know about icicles, but here to explain some of what we do know is NHPR's Sam Evans-Brown. Hi, Sam.
Hey, Virginia.
So what can you tell us about icicles, eh?
Eh? So I think we should start with you know, just think about the shape of an icicle.
What, you mean pointy at the end and wider at the base?
Yeah.
Wait, was that Taylor?
Yeah, that was Taylor Quimby. He's one of the producers on the show, and he and another producer, Logan Shannon, and I all went for a little icicle viewing walk to talk about icicle science.
Okay, so let's get back to this big question. Why this shape? Why the long, skinny icicles instead of big globs or sheets of ice like you might see, you know, coming off granite on the side of the highway?
Right, so the key thing is that icicles are long and skinny because the tip is growing faster than the base.
What? Okay, but why?
Well, there are basically three big reasons for why that is. Right? So thing number one is it's dripping.
Mm-hmm.
Every drip as it goes carries heat away. Right?
Right.
Right? Because water is this incredible vehicle for carrying heat. It's got the highest specific heat of any material that we know of. So it's carrying heat away from the tip. Also, the heat tends to rise. And so the heat as it is given off by this water rises up and you get this like pocket of warm air that's thicker toward the top of the icicle and very thin toward the tip. So the water that's dripping down toward the top of the icicle is sort of insulated by this little pocket of warm air that is formed by the heat given off by the rest of the ice freezing. And then as you get farther down, there's less and less protection, more and more likely that it'll freeze. And then the third thing is just the base tends to be more sheltered than the tip, mm-hmm. right? So if wind is blowing, the tip is out there and exposed, and the base is just a tiny bit more sheltered. So you've got those three factors that mean the tip is losing heat more quickly than the base. So at the base of the icicle, the water is less likely to freeze. At the tip, it's more likely. It's freezing more quickly. It grows into a long, pointy shape.
So interesting. But I'm still stuck on this fact that this is a phenomenon of our built environment. I mean, I have images of old Currier and Ives, you know, snow-laden trees dripping with icicles.
They're an artifact of our built environment. They're an artifact of heat leaking out of buildings. They're an artifact of poorly insulated roofs, mostly.
So obviously, if you have more icicles dripping off your eaves, it probably means you have more heat escaping.
Right. And so this is the, you know, up in Saranac Lake, New York, they have a biggest icicle contest every year, and the winner wins a free home energy audit.
That makes perfect sense. Well, I've seen some contenders this year.
Yeah. Now, next time you see an icicle, get yourself a ruler, hold it up to the icicle,
and
count how often the ripples appear. And you will see that you'll get a ripple every centimeter. And it's always that way, and they have no idea why.
Why?
What
did they think?
Well, the one we've really broken our heads on is the ripples.
So Stephen Morris is the ice guru. He's a professor at the University of Toronto.
My specialty is ice formations and icicles and patterns in nature and stuff.
Of course.
Right. Where else would you study icicles? He also studies a lot of other funny things. He studies the patterns that cracks form in mud when mud starts to dry up. And he studies washboard roads and the frequency of the bumps in washboard roads, things like that. So an interesting guy.
Uh-huh.
And so we discovered that the strange fact is that pure water icicles made of distilled water don't form these ripples, but even a tiny, tiny amount of impurity, like tap water or a tiny little pinch of salt in your water, and then the icicle will grow ripples. So we don't have any understanding of where the ripples come from, really. They somehow depend on the presence of a tiny little bit of salt in the water, but why that would produce ripples, we don't know. That's one of the main unexplained features of icicle shapes.
That is so bizarre. I mean, talk about the golden rule. There's a really distinct pattern.
And they're working towards this sort of unified theory of icicle formation.
That will explain the entire universe.
Right.
Well, it doesn't work at all, actually. At the moment, we predict that ripples of infinitely small wavelength will grow infinitely fast. So this is a kind of catastrophe that happens to theories. They predict infinity. Okay, so when that happens, it means you have something missing from your mathematics.
So do you need, like, you know, a fresh wave of icicle researchers with, you know, fresh eyes to look at this problem and sort of infuse?
Well, something tells me that wave is not about to appear. It's our job. We're going to keep trying and work on different aspects. Eventually, I think we'll solve it eventually, but it may take some time.
So okay, this is another frequently asked salt or icicle question.
How do you get rid of ice?
How do you get rid of ice?
I've heard loaves of bread.
Loaves? I haven't heard that one.
Yes, loaves of French bread.
And you just put it up there?
Yes.
It just melts it?
Well, you know, who doesn't want to stop for some French bread?
Well, what I've also heard, fill, you know, a sock or some pantyhose mm-hmm. full of, you want to use calcium chloride, not salt, because salt will
right.
damage your shingles, but, and you just stick it up there in your gutters or stick it up on the ice floe and it'll slowly, you know, work
melt
its way through.
I mean, I'm sort of obsessed with I want to smash all of these icicles. Like, I'm not a violent person, but I think it's really fun to smash icicles.
I mean, I think everybody wants to smash them, right?
Yeah. But is it a bad idea? Like, if you have a bunch of icicles hanging off your house, should you smash them?
So the standard recommendation is that you should be very careful as you remove them because you don't want to damage your roof, right? So if you just smash it and it's frozen to, you know, your drip edge, for instance, and you break off a piece of your drip edge or you break some of your shingles, then you've damaged your roof and your roof's an important part of your house. But you can take them off if you're willing to just be careful. You shouldn't. I would imagine you shouldn't just go with a shovel and start whacking at it, unless you
saw it. I did that exactly this, and I broke off a piece of the window.
Oh.
2 weeks ago. It was a huge icicle. I couldn't help myself.
Oh my gosh, it's so
yeah.
tempting.
They are.
When you think about an icicle, the reason people don't think, oh man, I need to act right now, is because they don't look at them and they don't think, they don't think of them as the symbol of you know, the,
it's
the
not like
problems
fungus.
With your house.
Right.
Exactly. It's just like, oh, this is a nice thing that everybody has. But really, you know, now that you know that they're a symptom that your roof isn't very well insulated and that indeed they're going to lengthen or reduce the life of your shingles, you start to look at them a different way. They're very menacing.
Get yourself a pair of pantyhose. That's NHPR's education and environment reporter Sam Evans-Brown, demystifying icicles. And we'd love to hear from you. Did you have any epic icicles dangling from your eaves this winter? How'd you get rid of them? And did you take any photos? Shoot us an email and let us know. Our address, wordofmouth@nhpr.org. You can also tell us on our Facebook page, facebook.com/wordofmouthradio. Well, that does it for today's show. Thanks so much for spending some time with us. If you enjoyed today's program, please tell a friend. After all, the best suggestions travel by word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. Until next time, this is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of Mouth is produced by Taylor Quimby,
Logan Shannon,
and senior producer Maureen McMurray.
With help from our intern,
Katie McAuliffe.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its Board of Trustees,
or its underwriters.
Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.